The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm not necessarily against Congress using a term like incitement in a way that does not necessarily track either First Amendment law or criminal law. At the same time, to your point, Ben, it does potentially create some problems in the Senate trial. Again, I don't think they're dispositive, and I don't think necessarily that you can really wriggle, if you're a Republican senator, wriggle your way out particularly convincingly based on this technical distinction. I guess what I don't fully understand is why they didn't just list out the factual predicates of what happened and then just accuse President Trump of what's really going on, which is gross abuse of power.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 12th, 2021. Donald Trump is headed for a second impeachment. A whole lot of people have been charged in federal and local courts in Washington, and an even larger number are probably about to be. What's more, the president's social media accounts have vanished. In fact, one of the very networks on which the president's supporters organized has itself disappeared. It's been a heck of a week, and we got together a heck of a group to talk it through. Lawfare's Alan Rosenstein, Bryce Klemm, David Priest, Quinta Jurassic, and Susan Hennessy joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk through it all. Is impeachment inevitable now? Is the article of impeachment Congress is considering well-crafted? Who has been charged and who's going to be charged? And what should we make of the actions of the tech companies against the president and against his allies? It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 12th, The Incredible Vanishing President. Quinta Jurassic, get us started. Where are we in the post-insurrectionist week? What does the landscape look like from a prosecutorial perspective? What does it look like from a controlling Donald Trump perspective? And what does it look like from an insurrectionary perspective? Give us an overview of the landscape here.
In terms of the prosecutorial landscape, so federal law enforcement and DC law enforcement have continued to arrest and press charges against rioters who were in the Capitol building on Wednesday the 6th. Bryce, who's also here, can speak to the specific charges that have been pressed, but it seems pretty clear that law enforcement is really going all out. I will say, from the perspective of someone in DC, I have seen lots of images on bus stations of the FBI asking for assistance in identifying various people who were in the Capitol. So that process is clearly still ongoing. And some of the material is pretty disturbing, including, you know, charging documents that show that certain individuals who were in the Capitol had posted and sent messages to friends ahead of time about intention to kill or kidnap Nancy Pelosi. Within the White House, I think the biggest blow to Donald Trump is probably the loss of his Twitter account. Twitter permanently banned him last week, and Facebook also suspended his access at least until the inauguration of Joe Biden, possibly further. So I think that's, you know, as far as Trump's concerned, that may well be, you know, the same as impeachment. And which brings me to Congress. Members of Congress at this point have introduced a single article of impeachment against President Trump for inciting what they're calling an insurrection at the Capitol building. I believe the last I saw, it was scheduled to be voted on Wednesday. I think there's still some uncertainty about when this would go to trial in the Senate, if the goal is even to bring it to the Senate before Trump leaves office, or if the idea is just to focus on the disqualification of Trump from future office, in which case it would be perfectly acceptable to convict him after he leaves. So that's where things are. Things are moving pretty quickly, but that's sort of a very, very high level overview of where we stand.
Excellent. So David, let's focus first on the president and specifically on the efforts to control him. You wrote a piece with Jack Goldsmith the day of the riot, suggesting a sort of roughly equal weight between 25th Amendment possibilities and impeachment possibilities. It seems like the momentum has moved decisively in favor of the impeachment option and away from the 25th Amendment option. How do you understand the current state of play in that regard?
It certainly seems that way, but there's clearly some things going on behind the scenes. The way that Speaker Pelosi is using the impeachment resolution and voting timing has been explicitly linked to trying to get Vice President Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment. If it were clearly a matter of urgent concern, of clear and present danger, as Pelosi and others have stated, then they would be holding the impeachment vote literally as quickly as possible. Instead, they're using it as a tool to try to say, Mr. Pence, if you don't do your constitutional duty, then we'll have to do ours, which I have to say does minimize that sense of urgency they have, since they're essentially buying time for him to do the right thing. It does seem, however, that if Pence was not going to pull the trigger, so to speak, on the 25th Amendment's fourth section a couple of days ago, it's not exactly clear why he would now, with two exceptions. One is that he may be seeing things in the White House, even if he is out of Trump's good graces, that we are not. And if there indeed is a Trump meltdown of epic proportions, it may convince even the servile Pence to decide it's time to do this. The second is, we don't know what lobbying efforts are being made to the vice president, either from Republicans on the Hill or Democrats on the Hill who have a relationship with him from his time in Congress or otherwise are getting through to him. And it may be that they find some evidence of logic and argumentation that brings him forward to connect the evidence and say, it's time to strip the president of his powers.
All right. And at this point, how certain do you think the impeachment is? Before we turn to the text of the impeachment article, I'm curious about your assessment. Is there any chance that this is going to fizzle out? Do you think it's going to be a highly bipartisan thing? What's the over-under on the impeachment actually happening?
Yeah, I have not counted individual members. I've paid attention to members like Republican Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who appears likely to vote for impeachment when he did not a year ago on the separate charges. So I don't have a tally for you of how many members will vote for it, but I would be shocked more than perhaps anything in the last 4 years if the impeachment did not go forward in the House of Representatives with more votes than it did last time. It doesn't matter if it has more votes than last time, as long as it's a majority, but I am virtually certain that impeachment will happen.
Okay, Susan Hennessy, talk to me about the impeachment article itself. There's one article, and it seems to me to have a little bit of a problem, and I'm curious for your sense of the article, and then I will raise the issue with you that jumped out at me.
Yes, I don't know sort of what your abduction might be. Certainly, this is a very thin and narrow approach to an article of impeachment. So there were, I think, a couple possibilities of what articles of impeachment against Trump might look like at this point. One possibility was sort of the broadest one. Basically, the House includes every single thing that they think qualifies as impeachable conduct between the last impeachment and now. So basically, over the last calendar year, right? Just kind of a big broad swing of the president has sinned against us in the following ways. The sort of middle path approach was to include articles of impeachment that were slightly broader, but still pretty directly tied to Trump's attempts to undermine the outcome of the U.S. election. So including things like Donald Trump's phone call, the recording of which has been released, with Georgia election officials, in which he pretty plainly and candidly directs them to assist him in changing, you know, in subverting the will of Georgia voters. And so sort of taking a kind of course of conduct approach and attempting to impeach Trump for sort of everything he's done kind of since Election Day. Now, this is the most restrained and modest approach to it, right? So it's saying, we are impeaching him for inciting this insurrection against the legislative branch. You know, look, there are good arguments, I wouldn't say for the broad approach, but certainly for sort of the middle path versus this very narrow approach. I think there's one big argument in its favor. And that's that to the extent that this impeachment is going to have significant symbolic value, the single most important thing is that it be bipartisan this time. And so I think attempting to draft articles calculated to get the maximum number of Republicans to be willing to join, not muddying the waters by taking too big of a swing, by introducing too many complicated questions about what should be considered impeachable or not impeachable. I think that's a smart a sort of approach to this particular moment. You know, sort of zooming out in, is this the best constitutional use of the impeachment power to sort of set the norm moving forward? I don't know, but as sort of a functional question in the immediate moment, I do think that this addresses that task. And I'm curious to see or to hear what you think the shortcoming is.
So the thing that concerns me about this is the word incite, which is a term of art in U.S. criminal law and in First Amendment law. And it has an extremely narrow meaning under Brandenburg, the reigning Supreme Court test, and meaning that I actually don't think the president's conduct would likely meet. If you changed that word to fomented, stoked, encouraged, helped precipitate, or precipitated, induced, it seems to me all the facts in it are correct. But I do worry that if you're accusing the president of an incitement, you're invoking some technical First Amendment law that actually probably doesn't stand up in the context in which they mean it. And I worry that they're actually making some problems when the president's lawyers in a Senate defense start reading the text of Brandenburg about what an incitement is and is not. And I wonder if they would have done better simply to articulate the facts, which are extremely awful for the president, and not try to attach it to a term that sounds in criminal law.
I take that argument. I'm less concerned of it only because I don't think that there is a particularly persuasive argument that statutory interpretations govern the, you know, impeachment proceedings, right? And I think that incitement is any Republican member that attempted to thread the needle by saying, I am voting against this article of impeachment, even though I believe that Donald Trump fomented an insurrection, but because because he did not incite one within the meaning of Brandenburg or within Brandenburg precedent, I am voting against. I don't think they get away with that. And I think they pay a pretty steep political price. And so, I'd be pretty surprised if there are many members who attempt it. So that might prove extremely wrong. And maybe there's lots of people that are just looking for an off-ramp and this offers them one. But I do think there's a strong argument for, the text of the impeachment sort of matching the public discourse and the public discourse that has been focused on this question of incitement.
Alan, what do you think? So you were, you on the podcast the other day were keen to point out that you don't think President Trump could be charged with an incitement for his speech alone. Do you think that same logic, which is the logic of Brandenburg, should counsel against framing impeachment articles in the language of incitement? Or do you think it's just a different use of the word? You're not here invoking the First Amendment standard or the criminal law. You're just saying basically, yo, he gave a speech and tried to cause a riot and he successfully did so. And we determine that that's an impeachable offense.
Yeah, it's a tricky question. So a couple of thoughts on that. The first is whether or not Trump could in a criminal trial be successfully prosecuted for incitement is a very fact-dependent question. Again, my reading of Brandenburg is that I would be skeptical that that would fly in a criminal trial. But again, these are exceptional circumstances and context matters. And when the president of the United States is saying things, it's reasonable to think that those statements might have a greater effect than when some random person is saying those things. And so maybe the bar for incitement is lower. It's hard to say. Whether or not Congress made a mistake or the House Democrats are making a mistake using this legal term of art, again, that's a difficult question. One takeaway that I had from the last time President Trump was impeached is that we in American political culture are running into a big problem in that we tend to conflate, and this is to Susan's point, the nature of impeachable offenses with the criminal law. And so on the one hand, it's actually good to signal that what counts as an impeachable offense is in some ways more expansive, in some ways more limited, but in important ways more expansive than what counts as a criminal offense. So in that sense, I'm not necessarily against Congress using a term like incitement in a way that does not necessarily track either First Amendment law or criminal law. At the same time, to your point, Ben, it does potentially create some problems in the Senate trial. Again, I don't think they're dispositive, and I don't think necessarily that you can really wriggle, if you're a Republican senator, wriggle your way out particularly convincingly based on this technical distinction. I guess what I don't fully understand is why they didn't just list out the factual predicates of what happened and then just accuse President Trump of what's really going on, which is gross abuse of power.
Bingo. That's my problem with it. I mean, they start the thing too late. They start the thing at the time he's giving the speech, not when he calls people to Washington and says it's going to be a wild ride, not when his lawyer, declares that we have to fight like hell, right? I mean, there's a pattern of behavior that they don't describe, and they replace it with this word. And I think it's a weak formulation of it. And frankly, I wish the lawyers for the House had, called some Lawfare people and said, how do you do this?
But hold on a minute. Ben, are you suggesting that based on the word, a member could in good conscience refuse to vote yes on this article because of that single word, right? You actually think that this is a significant enough defect that it would reasonably justify someone changing their vote?
No. I think if the charge is incitement, it gives rise to the argument, this is not an incitement. And then we get into this legal debate about what does and doesn't constitute incitement. Whereas if you simply describe the facts, and then say, and Congress adjudges, that this is a high crime and misdemeanor, then it is clear that you are not playing that game. David.
I'd like to build on all three of your comments here. First of all, the facts are presented here. Yes, the phrase by inciting violence against the government of the United States is in the first paragraph of the article, but the facts are there too. And there's nothing that says that you have to agree with every single word the way it's phrased in an impeachment article to vote. You could vote on the facts, and it doesn't really matter how they characterize the fact in that sentence, number one. Number two, we faced a lot of disingenuous commentary and rhetoric in Congress since the beginning of the Republic, but especially in recent times. But it would reach a new height of disingenuousness for any member of the Senate to claim that they agreed to the facts, but they could not convict because of the use of the word incitement in criminal code, which is not in the article of impeachment itself. That is, the criminal code is not cited as being relevant. And that goes to the larger and third point, which is impeachment is not a legal process. Yes, the founders put the word try in the Constitution for the Senate will try impeachments, which makes us think of trials, and it puts this quasi-legal gloss over it. It is inherently a political process. They did not put it in the courts to judge it like a typical matter of law. They put it into an elected political body to try this. So yes, if we're arguing how many angels fit on the head of a pin, is the word incitement the best word to use or not? I might agree with you on that. In every way that matters, it really doesn't make a difference.
Quinta.
Yeah, I gotta say, I find it really hard to care one way or another how the articles are drafted, which maybe is just my sheer exhaustion from 4 years of Trump speaking. But look, I mean, from my perspective, they should have impeached Trump when he fired Jim Comey. They should have impeached him after the Mueller report came out. They should have and did impeach him after the Ukraine scandal. There is an endless list of actions that merited, and in some cases, I would argue demanded, impeachment. And so the fact that, like, this is the thing that merits the second impeachment, look, is it arguably worse than anything else he's done? Yeah, I can take that. I think that's fair. But the fact that Congress impeached Trump once and then sort of is only now getting around to doing it again when he's done so many truly heinous things in the meantime really underlines for me how all of this is obviously, as David was just saying, governed by political sensibilities. And so I feel like, you know, maybe I kind of ran out of gas on the first impeachment, but I do wonder whether the right perspective here is just to say, you know, look, these are the articles we have for whatever reason we have them. People are going to vote on them or not vote on them. And any senator who is going to vote against conviction was probably going to do that anyway, no matter what the articles said in the first place. And so the fact that matters is the impeachment itself and the trial itself rather than the actual wording.
Alan?
So we've been talking a lot about the question of incitement. I want to also say a few words about the question of insurrection, which is part of what the impeachment resolution is charging Trump of, incitement to insurrection. I think this is actually going to end up raising potentially also some interesting legal questions because of the question of what insurrection actually is. So I am not myself a Civil War historian, and I'm sure there are people out there who are looking into this right now. But the question of what constitutes insurrection and the other associated crime of rebellion is actually an interesting one, and it's not that obvious. So there is a statute, 18 U.S.C. 2383, which criminalizes rebellion and insurrection. It was enacted in 1862 in the middle of the Civil War. And then this language appears again in the 14th Amendment in Section 3, which disqualifies people who have committed rebellion or insurrection from holding public office. What's interesting is that this statute has actually not been used, as far as I can tell, though again, my research on this is preliminary. It's not been used since then. And that's particularly interesting given that we've had other attacks on the Capitol. So, you know, most famously, we had an attack of kind of Puerto Rican nationalist terrorists who came in to the Capitol and started firing. They were not ultimately charged with insurrection or rebellion. They were charged with seditious conspiracy. So I say all of this not because I think that what Trump did cannot be categorized as incitement to insurrection, but that it is just at least notable that Congress is, in impeaching Trump for this, making a pretty strong claim about a criminal offense or a kind of conduct that, as far as I know, has not been charged for 150 years, not since the Civil War. Now, again, at the end of the day, I do fundamentally agree with David that impeachment is a political, not a criminal process. And it's not necessarily a bad thing for the House to come out and say, look, we haven't charged anyone with insurrection in 160 years, but we think we should do that now. We think this kind of conduct for the first time in a century and a half qualifies because of its seriousness. But again, to the extent, and this is what I worry about, in the Senate trial, we will inevitably again just try to shoehorn all of this through the criminal law. I think this is going to raise another set of tricky issues apart from the question of incitement.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I with all respect to Susan and Quinta and David's point, I do think it is awkward from the point of view of the people who are going to end up being the House managers in this, that you're accusing somebody of incitement to insurrection, and there's a plausible argument that it doesn't meet the definition of incitement and doesn't meet the definition of insurrection. But that said, I also agree with David and Susan and Quinta that it's perfectly plausible and lawful and appropriate for a member to vote on the facts without reference to the characterization of them. So Donald Trump is not the only one facing charges, and there have been a bunch of arrests around the country and a bunch of charges filed in both district court here in Washington and in Superior Court. Bryce Klemm, I think this is your first time on the podcast. Bryce is one of our associate editors. So you've been collecting all these charges as they've been coming in. What are we looking at so far?
Sure. So far, we've seen a total of 46 individuals charged, and 19 of those individuals were charged in federal cases, and there have been 27 charged in D.C. Superior Court. Now, the federal charges are sort of range from knowingly entering or remaining in any restricted building or grounds without lawful authority, all the way to making interstate threats. So I'll just sort of walk through briefly a few examples. One individual by the name of Lonnie Kaufman was charged with possession of a destructive device, and it was discovered that his vehicle, a red pickup truck, was filled with 11 Molotov cocktails that were determined to have the effect of napalm by law enforcement. And they arrested this man while he was trying to get back to his truck while the law enforcement was clearing the area around the DNC and the National Republican Club. Amongst other federal charges, we've also seen theft of public money, property, or records. And these charges have included the man who was pictured with Speaker Pelosi's lectern, and also the man that was photographed in Speaker Pelosi's office. Now, an individual by the name of Cleveland Meredith was charged with making interstate threats. And if you read the statement of facts involved in Meredith's case, he made some extremely graphic threats in text messages directed at Speaker Pelosi. And he was charged under a statute that makes it a crime to transmit in interstate commerce any communication containing a threat to kidnap any person.
So is it fair to say that most of the cases, though, so far are not at that extreme level of threat and violence? A lot of them are just kind of unlawful entry, you know, shoving Capitol Police officer. Like, how what's the balance of the charges?
Sure. So the vast majority of charges, you're right, concern knowingly entering or remaining in any restricted building or grounds, or concern unlawful activities on Capitol grounds. So the breakdown of that is 31 counts in federal court concern that, and there are only like one or two of the other charges that I just mentioned. And in DC Superior Court, there are 25 charges that are related to illegal entry and activity on designated grounds. And there are only, once again, just a couple of firearms related charges and assault charges against law enforcement officers there.
So, Alan, you and Bryce and Jacob Schultz wrote a piece, I guess, Thursday morning with a kind of catalog of possible charges that you think the feds would be looking at. You've hit the nail on some of the heads so far, which is to say the workhorse statutes do seem to be these forced entry onto federal property and destruction of theft of federal property. They do seem to be oriented toward the property crimes. I assume that the higher value cases are coming. How do you assess where we are in the process? Is this just the tip of the iceberg we're going to see, or did the feds give up a lot of cases when they let this crowd walk away?
Yeah, so I think it's almost certainly the former, that this is just the tip of a very large prosecutorial iceberg, and that the feds didn't give up any charges when they let these people go, in large part because these people did not try very hard to hide their identities. There's voluminous digital and video evidence, and it's not going to be that hard, as we've seen, to pick them up and try them for whatever crimes they may have committed. I think the reason we're seeing all of these property offenses is that they're just very obvious, and they're just easy to prove. They're easy to establish. They're easy just to put down on paper, get these folks into the system, begin the criminal process against them. But there's no reason, and this is what I would expect, and I certainly would hope, at least for the ringleaders and those involved in more serious offenses, that there are going to be a lot of superseding indictments that are going to charge more serious crimes. Now, what those crimes might be, I mean, there's a range. So presumably, you know, as prosecutors go through each individual's actions and they review footage and they review photographs, they're going to bring certain specific charges against certain specific individuals. So hopefully we're going to see some assault charges against the individuals who attacked law enforcement. We may actually see some felony murder charges, depending on the, you know, whether the conduct at issue falls under the federal felony murder statute, which does include things like robbery and burglary as predicate offenses, which may qualify in this case. We might even see things like a 1030 violation, a computer hacking violation, you know, if there was indication that people were mucking around on computers. Presumably, we'll see some of those cases. We may also see some more general indictments for the crowd. So I'm in particular very interested in whether or not there's going to be a federal riot prosecution. So federal law prohibits rioting. And I think certainly what we saw suggests that there was a riot. And so I'll be curious to see if the feds bring that. And then I think what everyone is really most interested in, and what the most, I think, serious crime would be, not necessarily in terms of jail time, but in terms of, I think, the expressive effect, would be if there are any indictments brought for seditious conspiracy, and we can get into you know, what the pros and cons of that might be. But I think the seditious conspiracy prosecutions are going to be the ones that DOJ is thinking the hardest about right now, and we'll see if those are brought in the coming days or weeks.
I want to open this question up to others. Do any of you have other expectations regarding what we're likely to see in the criminal arena, either more or less aggressive than Alan's anticipation?
Yeah, so I don't necessarily have a prediction. I do think, though, there is one feature that is emerging both from the charging documents that we're seeing and also sort of media reports. And that's that there were two different groups of people who were participants in this event. There was one sort of random hapless group that, I mean, hapless, I guess, is the wrong word, but right, who sort of didn't have a plan, you know, were part of the crowd, breached the Capitol, and then sort of wandered around, not kind of with any real plan. You know, some members of the press said they were asking where the bathrooms were, you know, sort of taking, you know, stealing things, taking things, taking pictures of themselves, but didn't seem to be an especially well-organized endeavor.
I don't understand, Susan. Are you suggesting that taking selfies in the Capitol doesn't constitute a plan?
It's a plan to take selfies in the Capitol, but the right. So there was clearly a group that was not particularly thoughtful. It's also pretty clear at this point there was at least a small number of individuals who were deadly serious, who traveled to Washington D.C., brought maps, were wearing body armor, you know, had real serious weapons on them, and whenever they entered the Capitol space, moved with relatively deliberate speed towards, you know, particular targets and communicated about those targets and their intention to engage in real violence. And so I think one thing that might be a feature over time is sort of that there are two stories of the insurrection, that one is sort of a riot, and another is a group of people who came to Washington, D.C. with a plan, and that those are going to be the individuals that will see really quite serious charges levied against sort of in the coming days and weeks, but that it's going to be a little bit confusing for a while sort of understanding the full story because this was not a fully coordinated event.
So one entity that does not require due process before it executes somebody is Twitter. And one set of events this weekend was a kind of cavalcade of social media banning of the president and people associated with him, as well as lower in the stack tech companies restricting Parler. So this sort of follows the Kate Klonick law that everything is really about content moderation. And Quinta, I want to start with you on this. We saw a remarkable thing happen this week. To what extent is it a long overdue enforcement of reasonable standards by these companies? And to what extent does it give you free speech anxieties?
Yes. In all seriousness, I think that, look, it is both important to recognize that the platforms are responding to what we can fairly describe as morally, if not legally, an attempted insurrection. And generally, I think it is a good thing that these companies are taking this seriously. That said, do I have anxieties about the specific way they went about that? Yes, absolutely. To start with the higher in the stack, I mean, Facebook and Twitter, it's just so wishy-washy. Like, if you read Twitter's blog post explaining why they chose to permanently ban Trump, they point to two particular tweets of his, one sort of praising his supporters and the other saying, essentially, just in case anyone was asking, I won't be at the inauguration on January 20th. And Twitter's reasoning is that this was interpreted on Parler and other services like Gab as basically a wink and a nod to supporters saying, hey, if you want to attack the Biden inauguration, go for it. I won't be there. On the other hand, look, I mean, when Trump posts on Twitter with a certain number of letters in his tweets, people interpret it as some kind of a message signifying that QAnon is real. I just don't know how sustainable that is as a standard. And I especially don't know how sustainable it is given that, you know, these platforms have to undertake content moderation at scale in many different languages and all over the world. So I think that raises a lot of questions about whether this is sui generis, whether Twitter is going to try to apply these standards to other leaders in other countries, whether they just got fed up and kind of said, screw it, and swatted him off the platform. So that's Twitter. As to Parler, the Parler situation is really interesting, and it reminds me of what happened with Alex Jones, the host of InfoWars, a couple of years ago, where basically he was on all of these platforms spewing out all kinds of dangerous stuff, and finally one service, I believe Apple, decided that they didn't want him on their platform anymore, yanked him, and then everyone else just kind of decided to step back as well. Alex Damos, who's a former Facebook CSO, compared it to everyone stepping back during a trust fall. And I think that's really what we're seeing here. Parler has lost support, as far as I can tell, from basically every level of the stack. The real death blow was losing the support from Amazon Web Services, which they depended on for their servers. And that, I think, raises genuinely interesting and troubling questions, because it's much easier to argue that a social media platform like Twitter or Facebook should be performing a content moderation function than a huge company that performs a really essential service that allows websites to stay online but isn't interacting directly with content itself. I don't know what the right answer is. I don't think it's obvious that they shouldn't have done it. But it's definitely something that I want to think about a lot, and that I hope we'll see some transparency from Amazon from in terms of what led them to make this decision and whether they'll be making similar decisions in the future, because AWS hosts a lot of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see whether, you know, we're about to see other websites coming down as well.
Right. So there's a lot here, and there's one particular aspect of it, Alan, that I want to ask you about. You've written a lot about the relationship between companies, law enforcement, these platform companies and law enforcement, as them as a kind of pushback against law enforcement. Here, I think we have this very interesting effect where a group of these companies can get together, presumably not in a collusive fashion, but in a cascade fashion that Quinta's describing. Once one of them acts, then three or four of them also acts, and all of a sudden Parler ceases to exist. And without question, however disgusting the content on Parler may be, a lot of it is, the overwhelming majority of it is actually constitutionally protected speech. And so should our reaction to this be, hey, you know, nothing prevents Parler from buying a huge server bank and hosting itself. This is, you know, private action is private action. It has no First Amendment implications. That's the end of the conversation. Or should we look at it and say, eek, you know, there's something uncomfortable about a group of private entities deciding that, you know, because some people on Parler are stoking violence, the entirety of the entity should disappear.
I personally am very uncomfortable with this. I think a lot of it depends on the specific facts, and a lot of it depends on what the alternatives are, right? So, you know, Amazon Web Hosting or Amazon Web Services, and maybe I'm getting my facts not quite right, but, you know, there are lots of places where you can host your site and host your service. And so if it turns out that you can't host it at one place, it should be relatively easy to move to another place. But if what you're talking about is whether you can have users install your app on their devices, well, you really have two choices at this point, right? You have the Apple Store or the Google Android Play Store. And so you don't have a lot of alternatives there. So I think the first question we have to ask, and this is just going to be a fact-dependent question, is to what extent in practice have the decisions of these private platforms made it more difficult for Parler or, you know, anyone else for that matter, to attract users and communicate? And the greater that difficulty is, I think the more concerned we should be. Now, look, it's not under binding Supreme Court precedent a First Amendment problem, right? The First Amendment only applies, it only limits the power of the government. But again, I think it doesn't, it's important to distinguish between technical legal arguments about the First Amendment and the broader values that underlie the First Amendment. And I think it's totally reasonable to say that the decisions of Facebook and Twitter have First Amendment implications in the sense that they have an effect on and potentially a bad effect, though of course one can dispute that, but potentially a bad effect on the values of free speech and free inquiry and free communication, those values that explain why we have a First Amendment to begin with, right? So I think as long as we're being clear that we're not necessarily making a legal argument that Twitter has some First Amendment obligation or Facebook has some obligation or Apple has some obligation to host speech with which it does not agree, I think we are still allowed to invoke the First Amendment as a matter of our national conversation about digital speech. And I personally fall in the line of being deeply, deeply uncomfortable with the entire technology industry coming together and silencing some voice, even if that voice is in many cases quite abhorrent.
Susan, David, are you crying in your soup over the fate of Parler?
Look, I share the general sense of discomfort. And I think, you know, look, it's sort of viewing the Twitter initial suspension decision in isolation, I think feels a little bit different than this kind of spiraling every single person, every single company, you know, Stripe, and basically just like sort of denying access to, you know, the ability to process payments and host these various sites, right? Like sort of the lower, deeper we get into the stack, the more uncomfortable it gets. You know, that said, I think Trump is a pretty specific thing. And I also think it's important to think about this not as a purely sort of a question of retaliation or distancing. I think it's pretty clear that there is an ongoing and very, very live threat of domestic terrorism between now and certainly in the inauguration and shortly thereafter. And so, you know, we think about these moments, you know, you have to sort of decide if the risk of what's worse, the risk of overreach or the risk of doing too little? And I think there are real and reasonable arguments for why Twitter and Facebook and sort of communications sort of platforms and those social media companies should be pretty aggressive right now and really lean forward and say, look, you know, this is there's been an act of violence. 5 people are dead. You know, there are we are seeing on our platform continuing sort of efforts to coordinate further acts of violence. We believe that this individual is in a position to encourage those people, and we can't take the risk that the person is going to use even if the person's the president, that he might use our company in order to encourage people to commit violence. That's an argument I think you can make relatively rationally for Twitter and Facebook in sort of a limited, okay, this is sort of an emergency moment. As we get into Stripe, as we get into Shopify, as we get into sort of all these places that clearly removing or not allowing Trump on those platforms is not about countering an immediate security threat, that rationale starts to get just more difficult and uncomfortable and difficult to justify for me.
Through this whole discussion, Ben, my mind keeps going back to the political effect of these takedowns, you know, the president losing Twitter and all of this. And I find it fascinating that a poll just released as we were recording this was a Quinnipiac poll, a very well-regarded poll with, I think, more than 1,200 registered voters and a margin of error somewhere in the 2 or 3% range. And it showed that Trump's approval rating is down to 33%, matching his lowest ever. Now, I can take that one direction and say, after inciting insurrection, you still have 33% approval.
Yeah, it seems pretty good to me.
I know. On the other hand, it tells you something, which is presumably at least much of this poll took place after the Twitter takedown. And if there was a massive political reaction, a belief that, yes, this is curtailing free speech and it affects us all, then you might not see those marginal Trump supporters that were between 33% and 44%, which was the last Quinnipiac approval poll, somewhere in those 11%. Now, it's possible that they're actually 20% and you ended up 9 of those ended up saying, no, the Twitter thing makes me still approve of him. But it sure seems to me that Donald Trump pays a hell of a lot of attention to his Twitter account. Some subset of the public does, and a whole lot of bots and others overseas do. And honestly, we do. The media writ large do, but also analysts and pundits and people who assess these things. But the people, at least based on this poll, for what it's worth, appear to think the president's actions do matter a little bit. An 11-point drop in a matter of weeks is not easy to do when there's already a pretty strong floor. And I think the attention to Twitter on the content moderation side and what does it mean for the new digital social contract is much, much more interesting, in fact, than the amount of attention we give it when we're actually talking about the politics and the way to move forward in terms of the actual governance of the country.
All right. Before we wrap up, I want to focus on one other thing, which is the incredible vanishing president. Ever since his hostage video on Thursday, he has been a very minor presence in our national conversation, save for his occasional attempts to hijack other people's Twitter accounts and the Twitter resulting game of whack-a-mole. David, in your capacity as the author of a book of How to Get Rid of a President, is the freezing and marginalization of the president in place a viable strategy for managing him over the last 9 days, or by the time anybody hears this, 8 days of his presidency?
Yeah, I find myself going back to 2 different presidents for very different reasons on this. But the common element is depression and some level of withdrawal from the public scene. One of them was Calvin Coolidge, who had a horrific story in the White House when his son died of an infection that would have been eminently treatable years later. But it put Calvin Coolidge into a depression, and he basically stopped working for a while. Now, that's due to a true human tragedy. The other one I'm thinking about is Richard Nixon, who in the waning days of his administration famously was out of touch and often drunk. And supposedly wandering around talking to some of the portraits in the White House. We don't know if that's where Donald Trump is. There have been some reports from what I find to be rather sketchy sources claiming that he is losing some command of his mental faculties. I don't know how much stock to put into those, but there is the possibility that we have to consider that Donald Trump is actually in some sort of mental decline, and therefore the fact that he is not showing up is the sign that he is worthy of a 25th Amendment invocation because he is unable to exercise the powers and duties of the office. The explanation that seems more likely up until now is simple sulking, that he wants to just pout by himself. But that is something Trump has never done for a long period of time. He would rather be out doing another rally. He would rather go out to the lectern and be at the center of attention again instead of being the man behind the curtain. I expect that we will see or hear something from Trump within the next 24 hours or so, given that the news cycle that he probably is watching intensely has nothing to do with him personally. It's all about other people reacting to him and doing things to him. He's never been able to stand that long, and I don't think he'll stand it long now.
Finally, Quinta, I want to end with you. Very early in the Trump presidency, you wrote a piece about the president's two bodies in the form of his two Twitter account, reference to the old medieval doctrine of the king's two bodies, the king as spiritual figure, that as the state, and the king as a human being. And you analogize Trump's, the POTUS Twitter feed, to the state body of Trump, and the personal Twitter feed as the corporeal presence of Trump, or the Trump the man. Now they are both down. What does it say that Twitter can take down the president's, both of the president's two bodies?
Well, I'll point to a piece that Jacob Schultz put up on Lawfare today, so Monday for listeners to the podcast. It really underlines, I think, the extent to which Trump's presidency, as Jacob writes, has become sort of merged with or nothing outside of the rhetoric that he uses. That, you know, without the presidential rhetoric, without the tweets, whether from at Real Donald Trump or at POTUS, that's sort of it for his presidency. And notably, Trump has been absent on the sort of public scene for as long as he's been banned from Twitter. It's a neat little encapsulation of how Trump's rhetoric sort of made him president and took over his presidency.
We're going to leave it there. Alan Rosenstein, Bryce Clem, David Priest, Quinta Jurassic, Susan Hennessy, thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Zachary Frank of the veritable firm Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our public relations firm is you, the listener. So get on it, tweet about us, share us on Facebook if your Facebook account still exists, pin us on Pinterest if you haven't been banned from Pinterest, make a TikTok video if the Chinese Communist Party is still letting you do that, and for God's sakes, leave a rating and review wherever you found us if Apple still lets you listen to podcasts. Our music is, of course, performed by Sophia Yan. Our merch is available at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.